You're listening to Get Fed Today, one podcast designed to provide the Christian a hearty Bible study 5 days a week. While our mission is to showcase a variety of different Bible teachers, if you want to access more content from a particular pastor, simply listen to the end of the episode for additional information. On behalf of the entire team at Get Fed Today, it is our prayer that today's episode encourages your growth in the grace and knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Opening Proverbs 18, if you have your Bible, a line of a movie, which happens to be some old proverb, no one knows where it came from, was given this, and this line was this: if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And I really believe that's such a principle in our walk with God in community, as well as ministry and friendships, and I mean every area. It's so crucial that you realize God made us for relationship. I mean, He is a relationship God. He is a God of love and a perfect harmony with the Father and the Spirit, the three distinct persons in the very nature of God. And yet from the eternal counsels of the Lord, He devised to create the world. And of course, the angels, the angelic hosts were there watching Him. So He created them first, then they're watching the world being created, and they're His servants, but not made for relationship. And then He creates in this little ball of mud, earth, out of the dust, out of the dirt, He creates Adam and forms him and breathes in him the breath of life. And he became a living soul. And then, of course, He brought His bride out of His side, and the two became one. God made them male and female in His image. He made them. So it's a beautiful picture, but it's really about relationship, from the very marriage relationship, and then family, and then friends. You know, this is a powerful thing in chapter 18, and I think of, just remember, this is wisdom literature of the Bible. You know, you have all the big questions answered. With Job, you know, it answers why suffering? Why is there suffering? With Psalms, how do we approach God? How do we know Him? With Ecclesiastes, what's the most important thing? What's the chief good? And you come to the Song of Solomon, what is love? And then, of course, Proverbs, what is wisdom? How do we relate with each other? Because you really do need wisdom. And you have the contrast in Proverbs of the fool and the wise person. And the fool is, well, the pretty much self-centered, self-directed, doesn't consider anybody else. And the wise considers others. And that's a large part of where they learn love. You can isolate yourself, and that's essentially where we get. In the opening verse of chapter 18 of Proverbs, you have this very powerful picture. A man who isolates himself seeks his own desire. He rages against all wise judgment. Now, the Bible speaks about being separated from the, you know, world unto the Lord. That's not this kind of separation. This is not a good separation. This is one who isolates himself because he has no desire to understand. He's isolated himself. He doesn't want to hear from anybody else. He seeks his own counsel. He doesn't want to be close enough to anybody that they might dare give him advice. So he withdraws more and more from people that could have benefited him greatly. I owe so much to some of my mentors that when I was at my wit's end and I didn't know how to handle the situation, to go to them and pour out my heart and get some counsel from the Word of God. And now I'm passing on some of that counsel when people call in the Bridge Bible Talk or ask questions in the church, and pouring into our leaders and who are pouring into others. And this is how it works. We all start out as babes in Christ. We're learning, we're growing, we're dependent upon those around us to help us, encourage us, keep us going in the right track with the Lord. There's not an isolation. You don't want that. So we saw already in Proverbs 17:17, where a friend loves at all times, and a large part of friendship is actually risking being not liked in order to do what's best for your friend. And maybe tell them something they don't want to hear at the time. Later they'll regret dissing you because they'll realize the wisdom in that. But you know, this defines friendship. Friend loves at all times. And it exposes a counterfeit where fair weather friends are not true friends. They're the ones that are looking for an advantage in some way. They flutter around, and whether, you know, looking for prosperity or popularity or looking for a better opportunity for themselves. But there is nothing more valuable than a faithful friend, not one who isolates himself, but gets into the nitty-gritty, the dirt with you and helps you and sorts things out. We were made for this. You know, Hebrews tells us, and as far as the church community, Hebrews 10:25 says we should not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. I think people get very comfortable in what I would call virtual reality. What we need is vertical reality, vertical identity, not virtual identity, vertical with the Lord. And I know the young people are putting on a conference called Vertical Identity. They're going to be talking about that with the idea of God as the center. But here we gather not as the manner of some where they don't gather, but we exhort one another so much the more as we see the day approaching. We're kind of encouraging each other. You can take one more step. Come on. The Lord's coming back. Don't get caught up in that. Don't forget this. Come on, you can do it. You can do it. And that's the kind of encouragement I had with mentors in my life. But I learned one thing about mentoring. My mentors didn't chase after me. They weren't going after me. Now, Lloyd, how you doing this week? You know, is there anything you need to tell us? No, they were there. It was up to me to go to them and say, you know, man, I'm really struggling with something. Can you help me with this? Or I could talk to my friend and say, my wife's really driving me crazy. What do I do? You know, those little things that you have people close enough to you that you can open up your soul to. You're not going to wear your heart on your sleeve with everybody. You're not going to be walking around telling everybody your business. But you have somebody you can tell your struggles to. Now, that's verse one, because this is really a picture of relationship that can get stretched from selfish reasons. And here, verse two follows that same theme. A fool has no delight in understanding, but in expressing his own heart. I mean, I can't think of a better definition for, you know, a fool that, look, why should he listen or care about anybody else's perspective? You know, it's kind of like children, you know, they don't really think, hey, Ma, I know this might be a real trouble to you, but I think my diapers are dirty. Could you possibly, babies don't even think. They just, you know, cry, fix me, and that will be all. I'll call you when I need you again. That's immaturity. Well, you go from that to having a circumspect life with others, pouring into them, encouraging them, but also being faithful to speak the truth, which sometimes they won't want to hear at the time. But there's no delight in understanding somebody if you're just about revealing your own heart. I always use the picture that it's interesting that God made us with one mouth and two ears because he wants us to listen twice as much as we talk. But the fool is just interested in expressing his own opinions. But in order to have unity, harmony, there's got to be a sense of being in one accord. Jesus prayed for us, you know, that we would be one even as he is one. And when you look at the church, how fractured it has been over history. How many denominations, how many differences divide people? Now, differences are fine when they're minor differences, the styles of worship, styles of this or that. That's fine, but when it gets rancorous and people are fighting to the death over this or that, that's when it becomes a real sad thing. And when churches lose that sense of unity. And having unity means there's, and just like in a marriage, you know, there's a lot of compromise with what you want, for the sake of your spouse. You could demand your rights, you could demand your way, and you can bully someone. But in the end, what do you have? Is that a relationship? Would you want somebody that you can bully and just get them to do what you want to do? You know, that's not much of a relationship at all. So the fool doesn't delight in understanding or trying to figure out the other person, a friend or whatever it is. Just, hey, this is my opinion and this is where it stands. But it leads to eventually verse 3, when the wicked comes, contempt comes also. When with dishonor comes reproach. You know, there's so many examples of this in the Bible that I couldn't even mention them. I think of Jeremiah, who was, you know, pretty much held in contempt for speaking the word of God and thrown into prison and beaten. And then when the same guy, Pashur, who rescued him, brought him out there in Jeremiah, you know, it speaks about how he said, look, you're going to go down. You're one of the top royal officials here, but you're going to be taken to Babylon. You're going to die there, be buried there. And all your friends to whom you've prophesied lies, you know, it's all going down. And that's a very sobering thought. I love what J. Vernon McGee said in one of his messages. He said, look, you know, when talking about people in relationship, he says, some cause happiness wherever they go and others whenever they go. Now think about that. I don't want to be the kind of guy that people are happy when I go. Rather, they're excited when I'm there. Now, this is the challenge, though. How do we get such intelligence? How do we get the intelligence about where we really are spiritually? Because we don't know sometimes. We don't recognize our own. People around us that have known us for years probably know us better than we know ourselves. So I tell you, the objectivity of others is essential in any relationship. Because otherwise, if you proceed without counsel, this is what happens. Contempt, dishonor, and reproach. And have you ever had a friend? And maybe you can think of somebody. Have you ever had a friend who kept you from doing something really stupid, dangerous, hurtful, mean? They saved you a lot of pain by keeping you. You were wise enough to listen to them to not do that. Unless you didn't listen to them and learn the hard way. But the reality is they were trying to prevent something that they could see clearly was going to happen. And they loved you enough to risk you not liking them because you were so huffy and puffy about your, you know, situation. And you were offended and you're going to demand your rights and you're going to go in there and tell them what you think. And your friend says, no, don't do that. Don't do that. And, you know, you kind of calm down, you listen to your friend. And you, as you look back, they spared you a lot of pain. What you can gain, oh, what you can gain when you humble yourself. And if you're new at Christianity, especially to be a learner, a disciple, don't underestimate what you can learn from others. For, he goes on to say in verse 4, the words of a man's mouth are deep waters. The wellspring of wisdom is a flowing brook. I mean, you want to be around people that are going to give you counsel, wise counsel, thoughtful counsel, experience. I mean, how much is experience worth? Look, wherever you are, however old you are, I can tell you right, you're a rookie at being that age. You were 17, now you're 18. You're a rookie. You think you know everything from being 17, now you're 18. No, you've opened a whole new world that you need other people that have been down that road to speak into your life. I'm a rookie at 66. I've never been on that route before. Route 66 this year, baby. Soon I'll be on Route 67. Never been down that road. And I'll tell you, I'm calling my friends who are in their 70s saying, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? Just for wisdom, because we all need that. And the words of a man's mouth are deep waters. And I think the best words, of course, in a person's mouth is prayer to God on behalf of others. And there's something that's... You know, every one of us have prayers. Oh, God, I need, you know, and that's okay. God is very interested. He wants to hear from us. We can pour out our complaint to him. He'll hear us. But then after a while, you realize, you know, there's something very unsatisfying just about praying for me all the time. My needs and my worries and my concerns. And then you start hearing other people's needs and you begin to pray for them. And then something changes in you. Something amazingly happens. There's a depth there that happens when you show now a care and concern and love for someone else, enough to pray for them. In fact, I can tell you there's people in your life that you would love to give advice to, but they may not be ready for it. And they may not want to hear it. But you can do a lot more by talking to God about them than talking to them about God at times. There are people you can talk to them about God. You know, God opens those doors. I had a divine appointment this week. A couple of them, actually. It was amazing. A thing I did not want to do called jury duty. You know, voir dire, the thing that you have to be evaluated whether to go on the journey and, or the jury. And I made it to Jurist 13. And then just as quickly as I sat down, they dismissed me. And I know why, but I won't go there. I actually, the judge, I had a great time talking with, you know, her about, you know, I said, look, we all have biases, and I had my initial bias when I heard the case, but I've been around long enough that when you hear one side of it and you think you understand it, it all goes in the trash when the other side comes. So you've got to keep that open mind about stuff. So she was very excited to put me, yeah, please go sit down. She wanted me on the bench there, but the defense attorney, not so much. So I'm not going to read more into that because only the Lord knows. But the point is, there's something powerful about when you care enough for others to pray for them and you're thinking of others And God gives you those opportunities to talk to them about God. But even more, when you don't have that opportunity, you can always use that depth to talk to God about them. And verse 5, it says, it's good to not show partiality to the wicked or overthrow the righteous of judgment. Now, why would anybody show partiality to bad guys? Why would you want to show them partiality? Why would you want to overthrow the righteous? By what world are we living in? Well, I can tell you why. It's usually for one of two B's. It's either for a bribe, that you're going to pervert justice, you're going to get some advantage out of it, you're going to be promoted if you go along with the narrative. If you do whatever they're telling you to do and you get something out of it, people will sell their soul for a little bit of advantage. And then, of course, the other one is blackmail. They have something on you, and if you play along, no one will ever know. Now, let me just say this. The righteous are eminently not bribable because they fear God more than anything else. They want to be honest before God, and they're not to be blackmailed because they got nothing to hide. So you can't really toy with them, which is why when things go dark in a nation, people that are not bribable or not blackmailable are hard to find. When people have not been stirred up by the word of God in their own heart, when self is on the throne, it's not a good place. So self on the throne leads us to what I'd call in verse 6 through 8, words gone wild. And that's kind of where we express to others and even sometimes to ourselves, because sometimes we need to speak truth to ourselves. But what do we do? Well, verse 6 says, a fool's lips enter into contention, and his mouth calls for blows. I can think of a few people that I wish would get some blows after the things they say. But I'm not going to deliver them. I'm going to pray, Lord, vengeance be yours, not mine. But at the end of the day, there are people, their words can soar through the heights of how brilliant and great they are and how puny and miserable and corrupt and evil you are. And, you know, yeah, you want to smack them. But wisdom gets a hold of you and you say, Lord, I'm just going to be quiet. Because ultimately, verse 7 says, a fool's mouth is his destruction and his lips are the snare of his soul. He thinks he's bringing you down by entering into contention, but he's actually hanging himself. Probably the classic example is Haman in the book of Esther. I mean, that is something worth reading just for the theater of it. It's great theater. I really would love to see more movies and plays on Esther because there's so much you could do. Everyone I've seen doesn't catch the fullness of some of the things that are going on there because it's the irony is so amazing. Haman is so full with himself. He hates the fact that Mordecai is getting honor. And especially since he was wanting to put Haman or Mordecai on the gallows to hang him because he didn't honor him. And now the king's honoring Haman and Haman does, or king's honoring Mordecai and Haman can't handle it. This official of the king is so proud. So he's snared by his own lips. Because word gets back that the gallows were made by Haman for Mordecai, and the king finds out Mordecai saved his life. And Esther reveals the plot. Haman wanted to kill Mordecai. And at that point, Haman knew, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. So he's trying to plead for his life. The king comes in and sees that he's like almost attacking the queen, and basically that's it. You know, let him be hung on the same gallows he intended for somebody else. Let me tell you something. That's called poetic justice. Happens all the time in the Bible. And I got news for you. It happens all the time in real life. If you are willing, and this is a big if you're willing to not be the one that brings the destruction, if you're the one that's not willing to fight for yourself and defend yourself and get out there and, you know, try to set the record straight, and I'm going to call everybody that I think that heard about me about this live lie and this thing, and I'm going to try to fix it. I got news for you. Good luck with that. The only thing you can really do is just keep looking to the God, keep going forward. Don't worry about all the stuff that's being said, because in the end, truth will bear out. And this now comes into something that's even a part of this idea of words, because the words that are spoken harshly to hurt, here's the real danger. An even more destructive work of words is verse 8. The words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles, and they go down into the inmost body. Hey, did you hear about so-and-so? Let me give you the real scoop. Did you know what so-and-so did to Mrs. X, and Mrs. X went to Mr. Y, and then this happened over here? And man, it's like we're all ears. We want to hear. Why are we so interested in somebody else's business? Because by nature, we're busybodies. And if the attention isn't on us, all the better. Let it be on somebody else. Takes the pressure off me. But you know, here's the wild thing. Satan, this is his trade. He is called the accuser of the brethren. He trades in this. He lives in this world. And when someone tries to sell you some juicy piece of gossip, information about somebody else's business that you have no need to know, can I just say this? Don't buy that junk. Don't buy it. You know, they may be the master of their lips, but you're the master of your ears. You can choose not to hear it. Now, God didn't give you ear lids, unfortunately. So you have to be intentional to walk away from that. You know, there was an old poem, "Who Am I?" I have no respect for justice. I maim without killing. I break hearts and ruin lives. I'm cunning and malicious, gather strength with age. The more I'm quoted, the more I'm believed. I flourish at every level of society. My victims are helpless. They can't protect themselves against me because I have no name and no face. To track me down is impossible. The harder you try, the more elusive I become. I am nobody's friend. I tarnish reputation, and it's never the same. I topple governments. I ruin marriages. I end ministries. I ruin careers. I cause sleepless nights. I cause heartache and indigestion. I spawn suspicion and generate grief. I make innocent people cry in their pillows. I am called gossip. Church gossip, awesome gossip, shop gossip, party gossip, telephone gossip, online gossip. It's amazing how much attention people spend talking about others. How much time do you spend talking about others? Compare that with how much time you spend talking to God. Or encouraging others rather than talking about them. Before you repeat a story, you should ask yourself, is it true? Is it fair? Is it necessary? Would I want it said about me? Those are some good questions. And when all else fails and you have a gossip at your door and very eager to tell you all the latest doings of somebody else, let me just say this. All you have to do is ask this very simple question and it will stop gossip in its tracks. Just simply say, can I quote you on that? No gossip wants to be quoted, I guarantee it. If you can't tell me and I can't quote you, then I don't want to hear. And that's where your intentionality has to go. I don't need to know. I'm amazed how people, out of curiosity, they just want to know. I hear stuff all the time, parts of this and parts of that. And you know how much attention I give to that? Zero. I don't care. Now, if someone comes to me and they've got an issue and it's something I can help them with, that's a different story. But one of the things I'll ask them, if they come to me about somebody else, did you talk to them about this first? Did you go to them first? Matthew 18. That's the essential missing ingredient that so often doesn't happen. You don't go to the person first. And Matthew 18 specifically says, go through the proper channels. You go there. Now, if they don't receive something they're doing wrong from you, then you need to bring another friend that knows it into the business. And you help because you want to help them. You know, that's the motive, not to destroy them. You're not going to blab it sideways 100 different ways. You're going to go to one person that can help. Confront. You confront them together. And if they still don't receive it, then you bring the elders of the church in. See, too much talk is sideways and people know little bits of pieces and then it gets magnified every time. And eventually, you know, we're giving people the stink eye we don't even know. Because they might have potentially hurt my friend who said this to that person and that person got there over there and this, and now I don't like them. That's crazy. So this is really just it's an awareness that we would like that junk food, that's a tasty trifle, to know something juicy. We are very tempted. Resist it. Close your lips, close your ears, and get out of there. Well, let's go to verse 9 through 12 because we leave off from words gone wild to kind of a variety of things in verse 9 through 12. I call it sloth, safety, and humility. Let's take a look. Verse 9 says, he was slothful at his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer. Wow, think about that. Not doing something is as bad as destroying something. Think about that for a moment. You know, I've had the privilege of watching things over years, and there are certain places that you might visit, and you see a house that's, you know, people moved out of it, but no one seems to be occupying it. And you go by, and a couple of years go by, and it's obviously no one's there, because now it's in just a few years of neglect, the house has fallen apart. And eventually, you know, you get to it, and now if the roof's caved in and everything's just destroyed. So whoever owned it, however it happened, whatever it is, but just somebody not doing the maintenance work on it, it falls apart. And if you want to know this on a very practical level, just remember the garage you cleaned out and made so perfectly neat. Where is it now, a few months later? It becomes a depository of all the stuff you don't know where to put. I'll tell you what, I would love an organizer special. I'd pay them good money. Come to my house, get rid of half of it. I have to take my wife on a vacation and get her away, but I would get rid of half of it. All right, I'm not going to go any farther on that one. But maintenance, for lack of maintenance. You know, the greatest danger that most people don't realize is one of the greatest dangers is procrastination. Think about this element of slothfulness, and work is one thing, but imagine being slothful in your own relationship with God. You know, think about this. It's the great danger. It's not that people resolve to go to hell. They don't do that. They don't plan, I'm going to go to hell. It's that they resolve to be saved tomorrow. It's the little procrastination. It's not that they're rejecting Christ forever. It's that they reject Christ today. Tomorrow is the favorite word of the Almanac of Fools. And I remember H.G. Adams said this, hell is truth seen too late. Procrastination. So that's a very powerful thing. And of course, the only salvation of that is you look at verse 10, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. So you have a sense that you're in danger and you know where to go. That's a powerful thing. If you're in danger and you don't know it, you're just going to take your ease. And you don't know, by not protecting against the danger because you're ignorant of it, you could be greatly hurt. And this applies in many different ways. I'll tell you, if the people knew what was going to happen with those fires in Southern California, they wouldn't have just gone to sleep that night and thought, I'll be fine. A lot of people died in ignorance of the danger. Well, there's a much greater danger of someone that does not take heed to the need for their salvation of their soul, and they know they've done wrong, and they're trying to balance it out with good deeds and the religion of this world. It will not save them. Hell is truth seen too late, but the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run into it and are safe. His name, I am that I am. Think about that. You know, whatever you think about God and who he is and what he can do, I got news for you. There's more. There's more than you can even think. His name is called Wonderful. Now, you know what wonderful is by definition? It's like if you were expecting a little tiny gift at Christmas and you open it up and it's 100 times more than you expected. You're over the top. You're like, what? As a kid, forget it. Have you ever seen a kid who thinks he's going to get the, you know, average toy, and you know, the thing that he really wants is this thing, but he knows that's not going to happen. He goes downstairs and he not only gets what he really wants, he gets more of what he really wants. He's squealing like, oh, this is amazing. Way more than you thought. That is who God is. He's much more than you think. Even when you're going through the dry times in the valleys and you don't know why God's allowing this or that, and you think he's forgotten you, and why am I even here and what am I doing? Look, that is always the test. But know this. The righteous know where to go in trouble, in time. And they return to his covering. When we partake of communion, we're remembering the covering, the shield, the shelter from the storm of the wrath of God through the amazing grace of the Lord. Well, verse 11 gives you another trust. A rich man's wealth is his strong city. And like a high wall in his own esteem, he's thinking, money solves everything. And in this world, you're right. Money pretty much solves everything. It's a high wall in his own esteem. I mean, no one can touch you if you've got enough money. No one can touch you. You can hire security. You can hire, you know, whatever you want. You can have the gates, the alarm systems. You can have all of that stuff. With money is a safeguard. And people that are rich feel that they're pretty secure. But there's only really one safeguard in reality. And the other only seems to be a safeguard. See, in his esteem, it's a high wall. And it's a strong city. He's got protection. But there is something bigger. We have a hope the Bible describes as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, Hebrews 6, and enters behind the veil. It's a powerful picture. That's our hope. That's an anchor. Nothing can move that. But riches, they come and go. Look at the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man was plenty of all he needed. I'm going to big builder and bigger and better barns, you know, with all the wealth. I've got my fields are prospering. I'm making it big. But he doesn't know his soul is required the next day. And then where is his hope? See, because verse 12 says, before destruction, the heart of a man is haughty, and before honor is humility. You know, the proud man leads to destruction simply because he won't seek any shelter from what he does not see as a danger. He does not believe in hell, so therefore he's not concerned. When I die, I die. Worms are going to eat me and I'm done. It's over. There is no afterlife. He tells himself that over and over again because he's afraid to stand before God. And he doesn't want to be around Christians who might remind him there is an eternity. Or even be around anybody that's happy with very little in this world because they have an abiding hope. That even annoys him more. So they can pretty much put their walls off and keep you out of their life. And they can, in the prison that they're making for themselves, they may end up facing eternity and it's too late. Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty. Pride goes before the fall. Now, there's some wisdom that we need in practical ways. And verse 13 to 19 gives us some good wisdom in settling issues, settling problems, settling troubles. One of the first things we can learn is right now, he who answers a matter before he hears it, it's a folly and shame to him. You know, prejudging, if you will. I mean, David did that with Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was a son of Jonathan that he rescued and he brought into his table. And Mephibosheth thought he was going to kill him. Mephibosheth got lame because in running to protect the baby, the nurse fell and dropped him and then damaged his legs and he could never walk right. He was lame. When David heard Mephibosheth was Jonathan's son and that he needed some help, David brought him into his own family, sat him at his table. And then when David had the rebellion, his own son Absalom tried to kill him, you know, Ziba came to David and said, listen, I just want to help you. And he goes, well, where's your master? Because Ziba was the servant of, you know, his other son that he gave to Mephibosheth to watch over all of his stuff. And Ziba says, well, Mephibosheth said, today I'm going to get back all my father was taken, that Saul, my father, was taken from. And so David believed he heard something before he heard the other side. And he made a decision to give all that was Mephibosheth's to Ziba. Later he found out he was tricked, but he couldn't undo his word. And all he could do was have Ziba share with Mephibosheth. It's a crazy thing, but the point is, he spoke too soon. Now I know you've never done that, have you? We look at what we get hurt in sometimes when we speak too soon. Worse than blatant lies is often a bias toward myself. And that's really what it is. It's a bias toward myself as I'm going to plead my cause, as we'll see. That's never a good thing. Because when you plead your own cause, you're not really being circumspect toward somebody else. It's a shame. I learned that on jury duty. You know, it's like we all have these biases. When we're aware of them, we can manage them. I was aware of a certain bias that I had toward the crime that this guy was, you know, proposed or you know, supposed to have committed, which he's on trial for. I learned a very cool thing about. I told the judge, I said, you know, this process has been one of the most annoying things in my life. I must say to you, But I said, but it's also been one of the most enlightening, because I'm looking at all these man hours and all this time and energy spent to give this one guy a fair trial, to make sure it's fair. And I'll tell you, there is no justice like the justice we have in this country. As all the complaints you hear about it, there's nothing like it in any place in the world. So I told her about that, and of course, you know, she liked me, put me on the bench for a short time anyway. But we have to recognize our own biases. Look, immature children can't see anything except from their perspective. They can't see anything else. You don't want to remain there. You want to be able to be quiet and listen. Don't answer a matter until you hear the other side. Certainly don't answer a matter if you just don't know the full facts. Well, the spirit of a man will sustain him in sickness, but who can bear a broken spirit? Maintaining that inner life is so crucial. And that's going to come in later in Proverbs. So let's move on to verse 15. The heart of the prudent acquires knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeks knowledge. So when you're prudent, you're going to learn. You're going to never stop learning. And the ear of the wise, you seek. You want to have insights and other knowledge. I'll tell you what, we can waste time in so much that is fake now. And all, you know, all the stuff, all the reels you're watching, I mean, half of them are not even real. They're unreal reels, let's put it that way. And yet they're so entertaining, aren't they? Oh, can you believe that? He shot that basketball from half court with his two fingers, you know, behind his legs, and he went in. Yeah, okay. Such a thing called AI technology. It can make anything happen. The point is, you know, when you really want to grow, you're gonna dig in some resources that are not just put out before you to get your opinion in a certain direction. I mean, this is kind of where we are so vulnerable with all the media, the legacy media especially. We have moved people in a direction, and with algorithms to find out where they are right here and to move them a little, inch them over here. It's a science. We are being played. So when we shut off all of the stuff that comes from there and we quiet ourselves before the Word of God, what a difference. Now he goes on to say, a man's gift makes room for him and brings him before great men. Now here the word gift isn't a bribe like it was in the other time. This is actually a thoughtfulness, because you're in a tight spot and you realize, you know, something has to be done right. When Jacob knew he had to face Esau, and he knew he left Esau in a bad way, you know, he was wise to give him a gift and say, hey, listen, I don't hold anything against you anymore. And behold, your Jacob is behind us. I'll appease him with the present that goes before me. And afterward, I'll see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So he's thinking about, you know, kind of soothing some of the tension that was before. That's not a bad idea. Have you thought about maybe writing a card to somebody that maybe you've been at odds with? And maybe expressing, you know what, as I'm thinking about the situation, I got to tell you, I wasn't completely right in this. And I just want to apologize for my part. I may not agree with you fully on everything here, but I was a jerk in the way I expressed myself. I mean, what would that mean to a person to get that kind of card, a gift, if you will, to settle an issue? You know, using a gift, a card, genuine thoughtfulness. Abigail, when she heard that her husband told David to go take a hike, I'm not giving you no food for your men. Who the heck are you? That's essentially what he said to David. And David had his 600 men ready to go and pretty much kill every man in that whole village, because he was so stirred up in anger. And Abigail came out and said, you know, look, you know my husband, his name's Nabal, which means fool, and he is a fool. And I just want to say, I'm very sorry for everything he said. I want to make it right. So she brought him all of the stuff he was looking for to supply for his family and his men. And David basically said, thank God for you, Abigail. God gave you wisdom, because were it not for you, there wouldn't have been a single male alive in your whole town, your whole household. And so he was impressed with her. And of course, the next morning she told her husband what happened, and he so freaked out, he died on the spot. And David said, Abigail, come on, you're mine. I'm marrying you. Point is, a gift, a sense of thoughtfulness that really says a lot. Now, verse 17, the first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. I go back to the jury duty. You know, you've got to get in touch with your own biases. You've got to learn to listen to the other side. And again, You know, you plead your own cause, it's a sign of immaturity. We can always appear right in our own eyes until we get examined more closely. But this is the challenge. You know, often in business we make a decision, then another, we begin to wonder if we did what was right. Sometimes we have a nagging thing, there's something wrong, and we try to convince ourselves our motives are pure. I recall very plainly, it's probably an old illustration for some of you, but I was doing some drywall taping before I came full-time into ministry. I was in the drywall union here in New Jersey back in the 1900s. And I got called on a job and, called back. My boss said, hey, the guy's really upset. You know, you left the huge, it just looks horrible. It needs to be fixed. And I'm like, what? I was such a prima donna, honestly. I was an expert. I was really good. That's impossible, I said. There's no way. So I went back and I talked to the super who was upset. And I said, this can't be. I know what I do. Those are flat seams. So as I was arguing with him, I took a flat knife and I put it up against it. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, this is bad. Then I said, well, it couldn't have been me. Someone must have did this. I was so proud. And upon closer inspection, I noticed that the drywall knife I was using, I had wore it down so much that it was so thin, it left a big bow instead of being flat. So it was mine. And after hours of sanding those bad joints down, I learned my lesson. But you know what? We can often be so confident in our own opinion, and we're not really listening to somebody else. So we hear the case, we think we've got it. Sometimes there's other evidence. Well, casting lots, verse 18, causes contentions to cease. So talking about learning how to settle issues, what's this casting lots? I mean, come on. That just seems weird. You know, we're disagreeing. All right, let's flip a coin. Now, it sounds really stupid, doesn't it? But actually, it says it keeps the mighty apart. There are some times, listen, there are some times it's impossible to come up with something fair and equitable between two people. They see their side, they can't agree, they can't come to terms. And sometimes it's better just to let chance take it then. Let the Lord decide. Let's flip a coin. But you've got to agree. Now, mediation would be better if you get some intelligent people to look into it. But if you still can't resolve it after that, why not? In other words, it delays a potential firestorm. Maybe a strange way of determining justice, but there are some examples of this in the Bible. A brother offended, verse 19, is harder to win than a strong city. And contentions are like bars of a castle. So see how much have revolved around settling issues in this passage. How hard should we have to work at relationships, first of all? There are going to be times you offend somebody. What do you do with that? Well, I feel I was in the right. Okay, but you've hurt a relationship. Well, they deserve it. I mean, we can excuse pretty much anything. But how hard should we work to restore something? You know, look, here's why, and let me tell you, this is the challenge, and this is what my big beef is with, you know, believers. The friends we choose comfortable friends, like an old sock. No challenges, easy to be around. We can relax, but we don't grow. Diversifying the people around you. Being around people that may rub you the wrong way. Getting to know their perspective. In fact, let me say this. If you have an instinctive thing where immediately you may not like someone, can I say you should question, is that me? Now, sometimes it won't be you. Maybe it is. You're picking up something that's just way off with this person. That's okay. But at least give it a chance. At least take the time to understand where someone's coming from. Wouldn't you want that to be with you? Listen, some of you guys can be curmudgeons, and people know you're a curmudgeon. They don't want to talk to you. So maybe try not to be a curmudgeon. But if you know a curmudgeon, go to them and say, why are you such a curmudgeon? Come on, let's talk. I want to get to know you. I don't want to stay away from you just because you come off so. And I know you can't be that mean. I know that's pretty bold to say. But I tell you what, I would rather hear someone say that to me. Hey, listen, I don't want to talk to you because I was afraid what you were going to say, and I knew that you'd have this opinion, but I'm going to come to you anyway. And I'm like, all right, sit down, man. First of all, I love you for saying that. I love the fact that you were afraid to come to me, but you came anyway because you wanted to settle something. Let's do it. Let's do it. And if I still think you're a crumb, then I won't say that. Point is, a brother offended is harder to win than a strong city. Think about that. Once you get those contentions going, they're like the bars of a castle. They can lock everything out. And in our day of easy transportation, relatively speaking, we can have friends miles away. We've got a friend over here, a friend over there. But, you know, people in our own immediate area, we don't care to know. How many of you know your neighbors? How many of you have communication with them? How many of you know their names? How many of you pray for them? The people closest to you. Do you think it was an accident God put you there? Oh, you don't know this one neighbor I've got. He is, I don't even want to deal with him. Well, let me give you your homework assignment. This is your challenge. Build a bridge. See what happens. Do you know that you can almost look at society in America changing by architecture? And by that I mean, back when I was growing up, my entire neighborhood, every house had the one design that you see only in decorative mode now, but you don't see as practical. No, these things that were on all the houses in my own whole neighborhood had a practical purpose for them, and they were called front porches. And the practical purpose is you saw your neighbors, you engaged with them. Hey, how you doing, John? You know, people walking by, what's going on, Joe? You knew your neighbors because you were on your front porch. What happened to the architectural design in America? At one point, it started less and less front porches and more what? Back decks. Now I can pick my friends. I get my friends over here. I get my friends over here. I get people just like me. Tell me how wonderful I am. Tell me more. Tell me more. And those are your friends. And you wonder why we're so shallow in relationship. Because we haven't really had to work hard at it. We haven't had to work at it. We find ways to avoid others. And listen, I know in a large church, you know, this is it's very easy to, it's intimidating, it's hard. You don't know everybody, I get that. But at least meet somebody new each week. You may not see them for a while again, but you know what? I'll tell you, if you meet somebody, the cool thing to do is maybe write it down in your Bible and just pray for them, especially if you learn something about them to pray for. I'll tell you, your heart will get so big and enlarged that you will find a capacity to love more than you've ever had before when you made it so easy for yourself. All right, let's move on. Verse 20 leads into a whole different section. And I would say it's called words, 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 they matter. Now, we've already covered a little of this, but verse 20 says, a man's stomach shall be satisfied from the fruit of his mouth, from the produce of his lips he shall be filled. In other words, you're not satisfied by what goes in, you're more satisfied by what comes out. Because verse 21 says, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. What a powerful statement that your words have the potential to bring death or life. You know, you could crush somebody very easily with words that could cause them to wonder why they're even alive. Or you could use those same words to build them up, to recognize God made them unique. Maybe they're not the classiest person. Maybe they're a little bit hard to get along. Boy, you could draw out some of those qualities and encourage them in ways that are good. I learned this lesson even as a young man, you know, getting married. You know, I'm the teacher. That's what I do. And my wife says, just don't teach me. I'm tired of, you know, being, because I can solve things. I like solving things. My wife doesn't like me to solve everything. She doesn't want to hear, you know, what she's doing is not the best. And do it this way instead. And I learned really quick, well, not quick enough, to be quiet and not use my words to tear her down. And Lord showed me how important that was. So I started studying her and watching her and observing the things that she was really good at. And I'll tell you, she could work for the FBI, number one. She could recognize a face. Even a baby, she knows who that is. I'm like, I don't have that intelligence. I cannot. She's got that. She also has a way of words with, you know, encouraging and writing. And so I started encouraging her. And the things that I used to like complain about, I just left those off the table, started encouraging her. And man, I'll tell you, would you not agree with me? She's an amazing pastor's wife, right? I agree. But I could have just as easily torn her down. And what are you doing with your spouse? Are you seeing all the stuff you don't like? And that's where your focus is every time you get together. Or are you studying them enough to see what their strengths are? Why you like them in the beginning? That's what I usually ask a couple coming in for counseling. If I don't do a whole lot of counseling, but if I do, I'll ask them the question, what draw you two together to begin with? What did you like about him? What did you like about her? And the funniest thing is once they start talking about those things, the next thing I know, the tension just drops. Oh, I didn't know you really liked me about that, hubby. Thank you. Oh, I didn't know you felt that way. You know, and you remind them why they got together to begin with. And all of a sudden, all the contention settles. It's a lot of fun to watch that. And you know, you could do the same with somebody you know they're at odds. Instead of listening to a wife complain about her husband and saying, well, you deserve better than that. Yeah, he's a jerk. You know, listen, don't be that friend. Don't be that friend. That's not a friend at all. You're only going to lead them to the divorce court. Instead, why don't you ask her, what attracted you about him the first time? What did you like about him? You know, and maybe there's some things that he liked about you that, you know, he got together. Do you remember anything he's ever said to you that you know he appreciated about you? In other words, you could build people up. This death and life are in the power of your tongue could kill a whole generation. Verse 22 goes on to say, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Why does he have to tell us that? Because husbands are stupid and they need to be reminded that even the painful times with your spouse are actually beneficial for you because you need to learn how to love. You know, I love it. You know, marriage requires 10 times the maintenance of a friendship. And you know, friendships require maintenance. I always love the saying, a marriage is made in heaven, but we're responsible for the maintenance work here on earth. Much more about marriage later, so we're not going to pause there. Let's look at verse 23. The poor man uses entreaties, but the rich answers roughly. You know, how you see yourself in the echelon of life is how you speak to others. If you see yourself above people, you're going to speak to people in a certain way. And a poor man, you know, he knows he's got nothing but to, please, could you help me? You know, he's trying to beg. The rich is like, oh, go over there. Go sit over there. Who cares? You know, and this is actually more telling about who you are than anything else. If you fancy yourself above others, you speak down to them. If you fancy yourself as humble, you're going to be gracious to others. And here's the cool thing. Is we are actually called to see ourselves as servants to one another. So if you ever have a leader around here or a person kind of throw their weight around and use their power to control or bully you, they're not following Jesus' example. But here's the beautiful thing in verse 24, in our final verse, a man who has friends must himself be friendly. But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. You know, indiscriminate friends will cause you far more trouble than an enemy. An indiscriminate friend is one that doesn't say anything negative to you ever. Always has to pump your ego up. Feels their value is to make you feel good. They're more trouble than an enemy. You need more enemies in your life if that's the case. Because you need someone that's going to not like you and tell you what they think. Because that will at least get you praying and get you back to reality. And there is a friend who does this. There's a friend who sticks closer than a brother, one who tells us the honest truth about ourselves, but loves us with a love that's incomprehensible. Jesus, the mind of Christ, the heart of Christ, right here. Lo, I'm with you always, even to the ends of the world, he says, but he loves us enough to discipline us when needed. You know, when I think about these pictures, you could recap a lot of where the tongue is involved in every one of these areas of relationship, friendship. It's really, you know, friendship and the tongue is a very fitting title for this passage, friendship and the tongue, how it all plays together. Father, thank you for this time. And I pray, Lord, as we spend some moments in praying for one another, I ask, Lord, that you might just pour your spirit out upon us. We need this time to wait upon you and to kind of absorb some of the things that you may have spoken to us through your word here tonight. To the degree where maybe there's some people we need to make amends with. Maybe there's some apologies we may need to make to our spouses, our friends, Maybe there's some, you know, aspects we, Lord, what do you want to show me? How do you want me to answer this thing that I'm going through? Father, I pray you give us some help tonight. You promise that in our weakness, we don't know what to pray for as we ought. We know that. We're honest with that. What I think I need, I really don't need. What I don't want, sometimes I really need. So, Lord, I ask that your Holy Spirit would help us in this time together.
Thank you for listening to Get Fed Today. Today's sermon comes from Pastor Lloyd Pulley. If you enjoy the message, you can learn more about Pastor Lloyd's ministry by visiting www.ccob.org.